this referendum that was held recently. So I think we're really well set to kick off today's KISS Café with a presentation by Guillermo Montt, who's our specialist in Chile, in Santiago. And without further ado, I want to hand over the microphone to Guillermo, and then I'll take it back after 15 minutes and ask a number of you who are coming with different regional perspectives to provide us with reflections and comments from your respective regional perspectives, maybe responding to some extent to what Guillermo has said, or just focusing on what's happening in your respective country and region. So Guillermo, the mic is yours, and we really look forward to hearing you and hear your reflections on what's been happening in Chile. Over to you.
Thank you, Shara. Thank you, colleagues. And this is a bit of a second round on the conversation we had a few weeks ago, and maybe a bit more interactive and informal. I do not have a presentation. I wanted to make it a bit more informal so that there's more back and forth and a bit more of a conversation than a presentation, in which I guess many of us by now are a bit fed up with. So I'm going to just give you a very brief overview and characteristics of what we have in Chile, and center a bit on four issues of what the current debate in Chile is. And then I'm just going to open up some questions, maybe for discussion, for our colleagues to pitch in from their regional perspective, because that'll be a bit refreshing from our side. I guess sometimes after a while we get closed in the whole of the local discussion. So overall, I'm going to put in my camera just to make it a bit more personal and a bit more informal, maybe. And so overall, so Chile, as many of you may well be familiar by now, has a defined contribution system with a solidarity pillar. So this all started in the 1980s with a reform that just eliminated the previous pension system and installed this defined contribution, in which you have an individual savings account, and from that individual savings account, depending on how much you saved and how much investment, the return to investment you receive a pension based on that savings. So there's complete uncertainty on what your pension will look like by the time you retire. In 2008, in view of the fact that many people do not save enough, a solidarity pillar was installed, so a non-contributory pension. And that system, with the 2008 reform, is largely what we have now, which we have a self-financed pension system, which is the individual contribution savings account, which has a replacement rate of around 20%. And on below that, we have a solidarity pillar, a non-contributory pension, which makes the median total replacement rate to go up by 40%. There's strong gender inequalities, and as you may well know, all labor market inequalities just accumulate over time and reflect on pensions. So we have gender inequality, socioeconomic inequality overall. There's high coverage in terms of pension, but there's actually absolutely no solidarity within the contributory system. And this is important to understand the current debate, because I'll get to that later. But basically, solidarity is the public pension, the non-contributory pension, and on top of that, we have the IFP system, the defined contribution. So the current debate, we have to go back a bit to the 2006, maybe, when there was a first expert commission. So several, around 15 experts gathered to evaluate the pension system and produce a set of recommendations, which led to the installation of this public pension non-contributory component. In 2015, a new expert commission was installed, and the ILO was part of it. Fabio Bertone was one of the members, and it was an international commission. And what was interesting there is that the commission had, there was a clear division in the commission. So there were two proposals, one to adjust the current system, and another is to create a mixed system like the one we proposed from the ILO. In both, However, there was strong consensus that there was need to increase pension spending from, on the one hand, from increased contributions. So contributions in Chile are 10% and only financed by workers. So there's space to increase the contributory side, the funding for that from the in terms of contributions. And there was consensus that this increase should come from employers. There was, but however, there was right then in the expert commission, there was division in how what we should do with that increase. And there was also consensus that there was space to increase the non-contributory component, which eventually was approved last year. So the debate currently focuses on what do we do with the contributory component. And there is, as I said, still consensus to increase the contribution rates. The discussion is what do we do with it? So there's currently is 10%. The idea is to increase it to 16%. So those six extra percentage points, that's where the debate lies. One position, which is the government originally said, okay, let's all of it goes to the previous the all of it goes to your individual accounts. So basically you save more, you get more. But that increase in pensions will only capitalize in the long, in the medium to long term when you have saved enough. For the people who are 55 years old, there's not enough. Now that position has shifted a bit, and now shifted originally to divide it into 3 points to your individual accounts, and the three other points to what they call a collective savings, which would be a defined benefit component. But with only 3 percentage points, there's not much you can do with it. And now the proposal they propose now is to split those 6 points into three components. 2 points would go to your individual savings account, 2 points for defined benefit scheme, and 2 points for a longevity insurance. So that would allow the mortality rates with which pensions are calculated to be calculated on the basis of a life expectancy of, say, 20 years of expectancy after you retire, and those extra 5 years will be paid from a longevity insurance. There is, in parallel, from the this is the position the government the project the government has proposed, and the opposition in Congress has said we won't accept that. We would only accept 6 points to a defined benefit scheme organized around notional accounts with solidarity. So the parameters that organize how the returns to your contributions would have some solidarity components to account for gender inequality and some vulnerabilities in the labor market. In parallel, and this starts complicating the picture a bit, there's a third project, a third proposal, which calls for the reversal of the individual contributions, the defined contribution system overall. And so this comes mainly from workers and has support from worker unions, and the idea is to eliminate all the individual savings accounts, use that money to create a reserve fund and pay and have a defined benefit scheme on top of that. There is, though it has quite some support in terms of popular support because it's catchy, the Nomás AFP, which is a strong, it has been a strong voice pushing for pension reform. In Congress, there's very little support for that, and among kind of the technocracy as well. So that's the current pension debate. There's three positions, and there's consensus to increase spending. There's also debate on what solidarity means, and the issue there mainly is that the diagnosis is that on the one hand we have low pensions, and on the other one that is due to low solidarity. So when it comes to solidarity, the debate is there is actually no debate because the positions are very different in terms of what solidarity means. And that's one of the questions I have for you afterwards is it's because when you say solidarity mixed system, there are these catchwords, these concepts that everyone agrees upon that is something we would like, but there's no agreement in what it actually means in practice. So you say solidarity, yes, we want solidarity. And some people say, but we already have solidarity. We have non-contributory pensions, that's solidarity. And the other group says, no, we need more solidarity in terms of formal workers or people, workers that have more stable careers, supporting workers that have less stable careers, so intergenerational solidarity, etc. It opens up a big conversation and there's no agreement on what kind of solidarity or who should be solidary to whom. So that's one. That's an obstacle in the process. And the same thing happens with a mixed system. You say we want a mixed system like the IDO has, and then the other band would say, yes, but we already have that. We have two pillars. And we have a non-contributory pillar and a contributory pillar. That's a mixed system. Period. End of discussion. So that I believe that in to a large extent the debate is kind of modeled by the fact that we have concepts that we agree that are desirable, but we do not agree on what that exactly means. So there's actually very little conversation in, as a result. In parallel to this, we, as Shara mentioned, there's a constitutional process that will happen, and one of the big and pensions comes in because part of the motivations for the constitutional process to even begin with was the low pensions and the discontent with the arrangements and the fact that many people do not feel they have benefited from the reforms and the direction the country has taken in terms of not only pensions but health, education, etc. So that, but pensions has been part of the movement that pushed for the protest that eventually pushed for a new constitution. So in that regard, and this is something we've talked with Maya and we touched upon it the 2 weeks ago. Pensions or in social security in general will be part of the discussion, and we have already been asked to comment on what social security should, how should it mean, or what it means in a constitution, how should it be included. And then a fourth point of debate, I believe, which is, escapes Chile but is part of the region, is that Uruguay is undergoing a similar reform process. There's a They have installed an expert commission like the ones we have in Chile a few years ago, and they will start on November 3rd with a 6 month time deadline to produce a report on a diagnosis. So that adds, it makes it a bit more interesting in the region because we have two reform processes that look towards similar challenges, like informality, demographic change, but start from very different standpoints. So in Uruguay, instead of the issue is not the fact that we spend too little on pensions and the fact that pensions are too low, it's quite the contrary. It's how do we make the system sustainable in the face of labor markets that are becoming more precarious and demographic change that is not supporting a defined benefit scheme like the one they have now. So it's more about parametric changes and the like. And they still have leeway in terms of legitimacy of expert commissions. So in Chile, expert commissions were used and abused, and little came in the way of reform. So now no one believes in expert commissions anymore. That is not so much the case in Uruguay yet. So in those issues, so the current, just to recapitulate, I think there are three main things in the current debate. There's consensus to increase pension spending. That has been there for a long time. It just, there's no, the implementation has been a bit tough because of these conceptual differences on what solidarity means and how we should organize that increase in spending. And in parallel, there's a constitutional process that is a big part, a big part of the motivations that push for it are pensions. So that's kind of the overview, very general. And I know I've missed other things that are maybe interesting to you, like some of the insurance schemes that they're thinking of, etc. But I prefer to hand over I leave some questions here in case you want to pick them up and maybe comment on them. I think one of the big issues and maybe underlying principles that make this conversation very hard, and particularly for us, is that pensions have consolidated themselves as individual property and not as social security. And it makes it very hard to talk about solidarity in the ways we believe it should be when you only think about pensions as something that is a result of your own effort or something that is individual property. So the question there would be how do you push for a language that is more about social security when the climate is about individual property rights? And that's one. And the second question I have is that informality and all the labor market determinants of pensions remain a secondary issue. How is there what has been your experience in pushing for mechanisms or innovations to increase the coverage of the contributory component? And particularly when you know that most of the people that remain uncovered have little in the way of contributory capacity. Then on a third scheme, there's another third question is this lack of conceptual clarity on what solidarity and mixed systems actually mean. And maybe we know, and but we're all coming from the same camp. So what has been your experience in promoting these concepts and making them in a way less about interpretation and more about a clear understanding of what they mean? And maybe lastly, a fourth issue that I think is still underlying and hasn't been touched upon too much, and is that there's little on the way of reforming today's administration to make the system more efficient and more effective. So those are the issues. Maybe I talked too fast. I apologize for that, but I just want to just put out ideas and so that we have an interesting conversation between everyone around instead of just presenting unilaterally. So I hand over the microphone and thanks for this opportunity, and I look forward to hearing from you guys.
Thank you, Guillermo. Just a quick clarification. Everything you said was very clear. I just didn't get the last point about administrative. What was that point that you can you just clarify what you meant by that?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we talk about administrators here, we talk about the pension fund management. So it's the companies
Oh yeah.
that run
Okay.
and manage your savings accounts. So
Okay.
there's little in the way of making them more efficient. There's still that belief that competition is best, and little in the way of targeting or focusing that competition where it's actually efficient. And today it's very inefficient. For example, you have the unemployment insurance that also have individual accounts, but it's one company or one conglomerate that manages all the record keeping and the collection. That makes it more efficient because you don't have competing firms or firms competing for clients. And the unemployment insurance has basically the coverage is practically the same as the pension funds, but they have 10,000 more employees on the pension funds that they have to finance because it's most of those employees are sales managers that call you up and say, oh, you should change your pension fund to this other company's much investment returns are much higher, etc. And so if you consolidate the record keeping and the collection, you can make it more efficient and reduce the percentage that you have to pay for the operation. So there's little on the way to reform that component of the system, which would make it actually more efficient and it wouldn't cost too much. That's what I meant.
Okay, that's much clearer now. Thank you. Okay, thank you very much. And I think we're keeping more or less to the time. And I think you've raised the number of issues that maybe as we go through the list of the following speakers, maybe some of you would like to address some of the questions that Guillermo raised. In particular, I think, there's some really important questions about what do you do in a context where you have this very strong individualism and this whole notion of individual rights and your savings and your pension is very much kind of built within this kind of very much an individual rights kind of system versus a much more collective and solidaristic understanding of what social security systems are about. So how do you bring that kind of thinking into this kind of public debate on these issues? Also, I think really important questions you raised about what does how exactly do we define solidarity, and what do we say to people who then say, yes, we have solidarity, we have a non-contributory system, and there you go, it's financed from everyone's taxes. So how do we get that issues of solidarity built into also the contributory system? And then I think there's some really interesting questions as well about, the whole sort of administrative costs that you raised with these private pension funds that you have in Chile. So maybe we'll just open up. And also, if I can just say, the point that you raised also very important about extension of contributory systems, extending the coverage in a context where the majority of those who are not included have very little contributory capacity. So that's also a real constraint. So can I please hand over now to Nuno for 5 minutes for your perspectives from Asia, but also maybe reflecting on some of the questions Guillermo raised.
Hi, thank you. Thank you, Sharda, and especially thank you to Guillermo. It was really, really, really nice. I'm just putting my time, starting to count here that I don't go beyond my time. I will start. I prepared a little bit my thoughts, but I will pick on one particular point that is the issue of values, the issue of how we look at solidarity and something. This is probably one of the areas where I've been providing more trainings in different countries in the region. And the more I work on it, the more I understand how difficult it is to pass the message about something that people just don't know what it is. I think about myself, and I think about someone who has like two generations of the grandparents, at least part of them, and then my parents having pensions. And it's kind of very difficult for us to think on something that will not involve paying to a pension system to one day receive that pension. It's very different in a place where people never had access to pensions. The generation before them, they basically don't know. And then somehow this drives a lot of the discussions on solidarity, the discussions on individual solutions, the preference many times for lump sums, despite you showing them from a technical perspective how much they are losing. But this challenge on understanding, on trusting that they will put the money in one system that is kind of a black box for them, and trusting that in 30 years, 40, 50 years, they will receive something and this will be a good solution for them is, I think, one of the big challenges. And it's a cultural issue, and I think at times it requires time, it requires experience. And the region is, compared with Latin America, the discussion is different because we are relatively late in terms of the public policy discussion, with the exception maybe of Japan, Korea, even Korea, it's quite late. With very few countries, most of them we are just in starting the debate is, and more than actually the reliance on markets, that's not so strong. It's more this idea of reliance on the family and believing that the family is there to support the someone when that person will get old. But this happens in a context where this region is aging at extremely fast. Much faster than Europe, and means that they have very little time because the fertility rates went down very quickly. The old family structure doesn't exist anymore, means that they cannot rely, and we try to show them this is the last generation who could somehow rely on the children, and this will not be possible. The risk is that, and this is happening already in some countries like Korea, this sandwich generation where they have to take care of the children and pay for the parents because there's simply no pensions or no adequate pensions. There is a big challenge on accepting that pensions cost money, and that aging costs. It's normal that if there was money spent on children when there were lots of children, when we have more elderly, we need also to accept that this is the new reality, and that we need to spend money on that group. For instance, Korea spends around 3% of GDP on pensions, with 15% of old age population. And there's a problem on the understanding of the costs. For instance, the answer that they are putting on the table is to reduce the accrual rates to keep. And it's not even an issue. I was there some years ago discussing, and it's they all discuss about sustainability, but the main problem is still adequacy, and they are not spending enough. They are spending, it's not really spending three. When I was there, I was kind of, after several presentations, like, but allow me to just my point is basically, I think your discussion is going on the wrong side, because it's not that this, and this is repeatedly happening in many countries in the region, is even if they are spending very, very low and not actually covering the people they should be covering, and much less providing adequate benefits, they still are already extremely worried with the sustainability. I think there was a narrative built also by World Bank, by IMF, and this is something that is extremely difficult with this mix of this reliance on the individual savings in one side and in the family. Then we have also different cultures coming a little bit from the colonial background. We have the social insurance, a mix of countries with social insurance, but also a lot of countries with individual accounts, not in the form of private solutions, but in the form of provident funds that come from the British colonial past. And this creates this mentality of lump sums and of actually being an individual entitlement instead of, and it's extremely changed. Even when governments want to change, usually workers are against. And I was surprised when Guillermo mentioned that unions were supporting this more pooling system, where here it's usually not the case. Even when they want to push just to do a shift from individual from lump sums to annuities, it's already a big challenge because the workers will probably even go on strike. I'm looking to my time. I think I already passed my time. Maybe just to finalize with some good news. I mean, Mongolia was one of the countries that many, one of the few countries that reformed the system. They have a DB scheme. They passed to an NDC scheme, but they had decided one specific year where from that moment, there will be the first cohort will receive from the NDC formula instead of the DB. And finally, they were never able to implement it because the lap will be too big. But finally, I saw a report of the World Bank advising them to keep the DB scheme and to avoid even thinking about fully funding solutions, what was very surprising, but maybe these are a very good news. Okay, I think now I'll pass it back to you, Shara, and I already went a little bit over my time. Apologize for this. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Nuno. And don't worry, we're still good. And I'm going to pass on to Simon to stay in the same region. So Simon, please come in.
Great. Thanks, Shara. I'll set my time as well. I have 3 minutes, so I'm going to cut to the chase here. I'm going to talk a little bit about Thailand and touch on some of the issues Guillermo mentioned. So the context in Thailand, we have a relatively young social security retirement system. It only started in 1999. After 15 years, you get 20% of your average salary as a pension, and then another 1.5% for every year after. So to accrue a reasonable pension, you have to have a fairly large number of years of service. The other issue is if you have less than 15 years, you get a lump sum. So we have two big issues at the moment here in Thailand. First of all, which Nuno and Guillermo related to, an idea that members want to take their money now. So misunderstanding or not being aware of actually how the system works, that it's a pooling system. And we've had this in the past, but it's exacerbated with COVID, is workers want to take it in lump sum, because the lump sum is obviously looks much more attractive, it's much bigger. People don't necessarily understand that you need a big lump sum for a small pension income. So they want to take their lump sum straight away. And this movement with COVID has been aggravated. There's people doing sit-ins at Social Security office where I work, and the ministry and Social Security is really under pressure. So what the implications of this, obviously, if people are allowed to take their money out earlier, lower retirement benefits, but also the inability to manage a lump sum. I mean, all of us are not particularly good at managing a lump sum, particularly with low interest rates. And what the problem related to this is there's a bit of a gap for people to come in and say, well, defined benefit doesn't work, social insurance doesn't work, pooling doesn't work, let's push the individual accounts, defined contribution. So we have the usual suspects there, but also some in the government who are saying, let's promote, let's introduce a new individual defined contribution plan. And this, of course, is very dangerous. We can look back at the experience of Chile, but it's actually even worse here, because if you did launch a defined contribution plan into the current environment, you're in a very low investment return environment. So they already have some supplementary individual accounts plans here. And the return over the last 5 years has been about 2 and 2.5% nominal. So it's not a huge amount. If you also look at the annual management charge, so how much are the investment managers taking out, it's pretty high in Chile. It's pretty high and probably higher than in Chile. So it's around 0.8 to 1.5%. So if I tell you 10-year government bonds are currently yielding 1.4%, you can see that if we do set up such plans, if such plans are set up, the net rate of return will be really low. And I think that's why what we've been doing in Thailand is actually looking at the example of Chile, looking at the example of Mexico now, who have just announced they're going to reduce the maximum annual management charge for the private pension funds. So there's a real danger. There's a lack of knowledge. So I'll just finish by saying, well, what are we actually doing in the ILO? So we've done a number of things. And that's my 3 minutes. So I'm going to sum up. What can we do? Well, first of all, we can push to improve the benefit structure. So instead of needing 15 years for a pension, make the case for a pension with a lower number of years service. We want to also increase the salary cap, which is limiting the adequacy. I think communication is really important. Part of the ILO project with the SSO is improving communication. We should realize that's not only to members, but it's also to ministers. And we actually sent a letter last week to the Minister of Labour with a copy to the SG of the SSO saying this is a danger of allowing people to take their pension out earlier. We need to improve financing. We're in a quickly aging society. We need to have adequate contribution rates for adequate pension. I think we need to make that point. And then finally, I think it's important to look at a whole, to say if the short-term solutions, it's not to deny a lot of people have a lot of financial problems, but it's saying for short-term problems, you need short-term solutions. If you take long-term funds for short-term solutions, you're going to have even worse long-term problems. So that's a little bit of where we are in Thailand, why we can look at the Chile example and say this isn't a good idea for Thailand, and where also the ILO can really make a difference to influencing the debate. I'll hand back to you, Chiara.
Great, thank you. Thank you very much, Simon. You more or less kept your time, and I think you gave us a lot of food for thought there. And I'm going to, without any further taking of time, pass on the mic to Pascal, who's going to be giving us some reflections, presumably from Egypt or other countries that he's looking at. So over to you, Pascal.
Okay, thank you very much, Sandra, and thank you very much, Guillermo, for your presentation. I think it was very interesting and striking to have a performance indicator that you mentioned, such as such a low replacement rate of approximately 20% average, you mentioned, which I think for, in terms of ILO standards, would significantly mean that we are far below what is into ILO conventions. So I suppose for us, it's an important element which would show that the schemes are not up to the level requested by international labor standards. Similarly, as you raised the question, I didn't get what is the coverage rate, but basically you also mentioned that you have issues to cover workers with limited contributory capacity, which probably means that the scheme is also failing, or the system is failing in terms of coverage, except maybe with this solidarity pillar. For the context of Egypt, if I can make some relations, probably what has been done over the years is what we've seen is that there is a weakening of the workers' union over the years, and that might be a little bit related to the political situation when Chile was under more or less a military government, and in Egypt we had never managed really to have a full transition to democracy. So over the years, the union movement have been weakened. And what happened actually from 27 in Egypt, they had a strong discussion between the Ministry of Finance and the World Bank to reform the defined benefit system into a very similar system to the Chilean model with a national defined account with a three-pillar approach as well. And as well, there was also a solidarity component to a very minimalistic level. So hopefully, well, a law was adopted in 2010 in Egypt to move towards a defined contribution scheme, but the revolution 1 year later changed completely the political scene, and that law was never implemented. So that was, in terms of timing, that was a good opportunity for the ILO to come in. And basically, at the same time, while before the revolution, the pension fund was under the supervision of the Ministry of Finance. It shifted after the revolution and the new constitution. It shifted from the responsibility of the Ministry of Finance to the Ministry of Social Solidarity, which is more or less which is our constituent. So that was actually a good opportunity, because after the failure of this World Bank type of reform, the Ministry of Social Solidarity contacted the ILO to discuss on alternative reforms for the pension system. And we developed more or less the approach that ILO is usually supporting, meaning more moving towards a parametric reform instead of a systemic reform like the Chilean model. So this is, let's say, the political context. We managed to move towards a parametric reform last year in a 2019 law, which actually was quite a comprehensive law, modifying not only the contribution, but the benefit formula, the benefit level, and also merging all the different schemes, because they were quite a segmented system with four or five different laws. Now they all unified under one law with the same type of benefit. So I think this has avoided both the move towards the defined contribution, but also this global and comprehensive reform was an opportunity for the system to be strengthened at the same time. So that's the Egyptian context, which of course is a bit different, but still we are in a context where we are still a military led government. We still have weak unions. So that's the context, but I believe for ILO it's very important to strengthen workers' union, as they may represent a counterpower and also play a role in this debate to improve long-term benefits. So this is my small contribution, and I'm happy to answer to other questions. Thank you.
Sorry, Pascal, if I can just quickly ask, what kind of coverage are we talking about within the contributory system in the Egyptian case? What percentage, roughly, of the labor force is contributing?
We are over 40% at the moment.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you very much, Pascal. And I'm sure there'll be questions because I'm just going through the short presentations and then hopefully there'll be time for questions and answers. And I'm just going to pass on now from Egypt, hopping over to Lebanon, to Luca, who's hopefully here and will take up a role. Luca, are you here? We cannot hear you. Maybe your mic is muted. Maybe he's not online. Okay, so maybe I'll skip Luca for now. And can I hand over to André, who is going to sort of make a few points about South Africa, and then and then hopefully if Luca is back by then, we will go back to Luca. If not, then André, you have the mic.
Okay, thank you, Sarah. Yeah, I've been asked to take over Andrew's presentation because he cannot make it, but I've worked quite extensively with him on the work we are doing in South Africa. So maybe I'll explain briefly what we're doing in South Africa. So please stop me when I'll be at 5 minutes. As most of you probably already know, in South Africa, the pension system is mainly a private, with mainly defined contribution schemes for workers in the formal sector. And you have also a defined benefit schemes for the for the civil servant. There is approximately 1.3 million worker in the civil servant pension schemes. For old age, you also have for people that have, there is a universal but means tested old age grant that exists. And in between those, in fact, I think it's figures from 2017 or 18, there is approximately 11.1 million workers in the private sector that are members of private pension arrangement. And out of 21.7 million workers in the labor market, and in the in also in 2017, you had 3.4 million people above age 60, which represent 72% of the people above age 60 that were receiving this universal old age grant. So it makes a lot of people falling between these two, I would say, non-integrated system, the universal mean tested and the private pension arrangement. The Department of Social Development estimates that there is approximately 6.2 million formal workers, primarily low income earners, that are not covered by private pension arrangement. And there is approximately 1 million people above age 60 that are completely excluded from the existing state benefits. So the conclusion of, I mean, I think they're talking about reforming the pension systems in South Africa since maybe close to 20 years in South Africa. This is something a bit similar that Luca would probably talk about what's going on in Lebanon also. So since 2017-18, we're working. This was started with Luis Frota when he was in Pretoria. There are discussions at the level of the National Economic Development and Labor Council to do a reform, and we are supporting this reform. And what they want to put in place is a system of multi-pillar systems. So they are looking at having this old age pension become a universal pension. And then they want to build a second pillar, which would be a national social security fund, which would be a contributory defined benefit pension. And they would keep, the earnings cap on this level up too high to leave space to the private arrangement, because there's a lot of lobbying and they are very strong. They do strong lobbying, the private sector, those who manage these large funds, fully funded pension funds. So there's a lot of lobbying. So the idea was to keep the earnings cap at the like I would say, the cap at the level of the what is prescribed in the ILO convention, approximately like 125% of the average wage. In their proposed, I would say, institutional framework, they want to establish a social security oversight department in order to bring the existing social security institution under a single oversight department. If there is the social security that is paying the grant, they're also paying an invalidity grant. They also have an institution for unemployment. They have a non-unemployment insurance fund. They want to bring the various social security institutions and the NSSF under the same oversight department. They want to establish this new national social security fund to manage the new fund. And they want also to create a common public interface for social security, which would be a joint delivery platform and organization that would cover all aspects of social security. And also they want to create, for a third pillar, an auto-enrollment based private pension savings arrangement, also with a default fund that would be managed by the NSSF, that would be the NSSF default fund. And this, the idea of this NSSS default design fund is to, the objective is to ensure an adequate pension for workers. This default fund would be run by the NSSF. It would be a kind of a choice option for anyone enrolled in an employer provided savings arrangement. The objective here is to increase the standards in private pensions. There would be also in the discussion, there would be an approved fund framework and tax incentive would only be offered for arrangement that would comply with the approved fund frameworks that is envisioned. The idea of when they look at the design of these three pillar system is that for workers at the earning ceilings, which would be set, as I explained, at approximately 125% of the average wage workers in the formal sector, the income replacement would be approximately 40% at this level. It would start at the higher level at the level of the minimum wage when combining the universal pension, which is approximately at the level of the minimum wage, that would replace with the close to 140%, 135% of the earnings, and it's decreased rapidly to reach around 40% at the level of the earning ceilings, and above this, it would be then the for those above this earning ceilings, they would have to compensate with their private DC or other private schemes or the NSSF default DC schemes, and it could also contribute more in order to replace more than 40% of their earnings. So I don't know how much time I took, but that would...
I think...
Yeah. Go ahead.
No. Please just give your final wrap up and then we'll...
No, it was just finishing because we had a lot of interesting stuff that we could talk about for the financing of this NSSF second pillar. But that could be the subject of another Kiss Cafe. And maybe there was something, I don't know if we can start the round of questions to the others' presentation, but because there is something that Guillermo touched very briefly about this longevity pension, which could be an interesting thing to discuss also, because on one side, it is a way for in the schemes that have like a basic defined pillar, but with like a third pillar, which is defined contribution. The problem with defined contribution and these individual accounts is when you get to retirement, if you have to buy an annuity, the interest rates are so low right now that you don't get a very large annuity when you buy a pension. But if you want to live with this yourself with this lump sum amount, As Simon mentioned, people, they don't know what to do with these lump sum amount. They don't know how long they can live with this amount. So the option of a longevity pension that kicks in when you reach, for example, 70 or 75, is you have now an horizon to that you know that if you retire at 60, the longevity pension kicks in at 70, then you know that you have 10 years to spend your DC account. So, and because you know that at age 70, then you will have an additional defined benefit pension that will kick in. The less interesting side of this is that in countries where you have huge discrepancies between on the mortality, on life expectancy between the low earners and the high earners, this is seen as a pension that is like the low earners that are subsidizing the pension of the high earners, because this is in majority the high earners who will get access to this longevity pension. So there's a lot of interesting discussion we can have on this, but this is something that I've heard in other countries that are discussed, and it seems that it is also now discussed in Chile. So over to you, Sharon.
Okay, thank you very much, André, and for also kicking off the discussion now with some really interesting points on this longevity pensions. I want to hand over now to Luca, very conscious that we are running a bit out of time. So Luca, over to you, please.
Yeah, Sharon, I hope you can hear me now.
Yes, we can, very clearly.
Thank you very much to everybody who spoke so far. I think it's been great to see how some really common threads of discussion across all countries. And I'm just going to really briefly touch on a few points. The first, the issue of lump sum reform. Lebanon is one of the only country in the MENA region without annuities. And much of the ALO involvement in the past really 20 years has been about a reform into a private pension system with annuities for the private sector. Reaction to what others were saying, prior to the crisis period, there was a lot of demand for this shift, particularly because there is a public pension system that pays out annuities and there is a clear understanding in the population of the benefits of that model. Yet in the current crisis context, this climate is a little bit changing. And I think it's interesting to reflect on how the lump sum end of service model serves both the purpose of retirement insurance, but also to a large extent serves an implicit purpose of unemployment insurance. In the absence of other unemployment benefits, workers tend to cash out their lump sum entitlements at time of economic crisis, such as now. And therefore, it's proving to be harder, I think, and it will be harder to continue to make the point in the coming months that it's important to move towards an annuity model for retirement if we don't also resolve at the same time the crucial matter of how to provide income replacement in case and income security in case of unemployment. So that was point number one. Point number two, on the issue of solidarity, I think here also in Lebanon, there's been a lot of debate on the kind of the trade-off between fairness and solidarity. When I mean fairness, this idea of having a clear return to contributions and that people who put in more somehow get out a fair share of what they've put in. And this is plays particularly to the political economy in Lebanon, the coexistence of different religious groups and the risk, perceived risk, that some religious groups or parts in society are going to take advantage of the system by extracting from it more than actually they put in. When we also consider that the National Social Security Fund is somehow under control of one of these, sectarian groups, as they are called officially in Lebanon. So that on the one hand, and the concerns of solidarity have really brought to Lebanon this very familiar, I would say, dialectic between the defined contributions and defined benefits. And we have quite successfully made in the past couple of years the point of adopting a model that has a strong DB component, really building on two points. The first is adequacy, and really showing how a DC, unsufficiently funded DC scheme would have not led to the level of adequacy for all participating workers. And the second, really the point of intergenerational solidarity has played very strongly, and really recognizing how in the absence of a mechanism to kind of pool risks across generations with low investment returns at particular period of time with financial crisis, kind of a recurrent feature of our current times, certain generations really are much much more affected than others. And so, again, in terms of adequacy, the levels of benefits enjoyed under a DC scheme is subject to all that volatility, which people don't like. Where it has been a bit of a harder point is on matters of horizontal solidarity. So how much solidarity do we want to have within generations, and particularly how much of that solidarity should happen within the social security system, or how much of that should be the role of the state, and therefore how much of that should take the formal shape of sort of subsidy systems and sort of direct use of tax revenue rather than social contributions revenue to achieve that horizontal solidarity. And I think that's a point I hope, I think as a team we need to discuss further, because we know the World Bank has a very clear point on that. They say any horizontal solidarity outside the system, I think we need to engage with that. The third point, we need to think about the risks of DB, and we know that in our standards, defined benefits are the norm, but how can we prevent the concerns that come with DB schemes in terms of their inertia and the fact that they can over time become financially unsustainable? And here the Lebanon example has been quite interesting in terms of developing an hybrid model with automatic adjustments, with adjustments for life expectancy, and with some sort of conditional indexation mechanism, both for past service and for future indexation of pensions, which allow some safety valves in a DB system so that it will remain balanced, it will remain financially sustainable over time by not letting politicians have to take the difficult parametric reform decision in the future, but really building in some automatic model mechanism so that the DB model will remain somehow in financial balance without too much political interference. I guess the last point I wanted to make is on trust. Many of us spoke about trust, and here in Lebanon is very clear that we cannot reform the pension system unless we can reassure everybody in this very particular social contract that is Lebanon, that the National Social Security institution can be trusted by all, and that its governance is effective. I also had some final thoughts on the point of informality that was raised, and maybe I just say it in 30 seconds. I think that amongst the many things we have to think about as a team, there is the issue of whether we need to have a multi-tier approach to entering a retirement system. I mean, in many systems are functioning on a either in or out principle. Either you're in with sometimes relatively generous, many times over our minimum convention levels, or staying completely out. So is it reasonable to figure mechanisms so that a first step in the system can be offered, compliant with our standards, to those who have more reduced contributory capacity in recognition of that, and how to differentiate and how to identify segments of the labor force or the workforce that can access these sort of more incremental steps in the ladder, I think is an intellectual challenge that I hope all of us as a team can further engage with in the coming months and years. Over to you, Shara.
Thank you very much, Luca. I'm impressed with how much you managed to squeeze into the little time that you had. I think there was a lot of really interesting points there to pick up on on the issues around solidarity, in particular, that you said, in societies where there are such deep segmentations, how do you create that sense of solidarity? Issues also around the issues around adequacy being very important across generations, but also horizontal solidarity, and very interesting what you said about the sort of the way in which you can automatically build in through the indexations ways in which the DB system can become also reduce its inertia and be a bit more agile and responsive, so you don't end up with having to make big systemic changes and get politicians to come in with their kind of reforms. So there was a lot there. There was also some interesting conversations going on the side about the costs of a transition from a DB to a defined contribution system, and how often the costs of that transition are not always made very clear before such big changes are made. And then that also really is very important to be very transparent and open about these transition costs. So I really want to open the floor, even though we're out of time, because the discussion, the presentations that you all made was incredibly rich. So, but it's good to hear a few maybe reactions from colleagues who haven't spoken yet. Any questions you may have, or comments or thoughts that you may come out with, please take the floor, open your mic and come in. We don't have much time, but I do want to give another 10 minutes, if you all allow us to go over time, to just hear a few reactions. So colleagues, please come in if you want to make any comments or raise any reactions you may have. Okay, maybe people are a bit overwhelmed. There was a lot of rich discussion going on.
Sarah, if no one has to add something.
Yes, please come in, yes. Pascal.
Yeah, so I just wanted I forgot to reply to the point about informal economy workers and extension. And we have the same issue in North Africa region. And it seems that whenever, you know, in an employment relationship, whenever there is an opportunity for an employer to pay less and to escape to the contribution, it seems they will do it, you know. So of course, I think we have to investigate into modern solution and so on. And at the moment in Egypt, we start discussing on how we could adapt the service voucher, so-called chèque emploi service in France, you know, in which an employer, for example, for employing a domestic worker or any person maybe in the informal economy, would pay a cheque which includes social security contribution. So a certain percentage of this check would include the social security contribution, but at the same time, the employer could deduct part of his expenditure from his profit or from his income tax, you know. So this is something global which has to be discussed also with Ministry of Finance. But more and more Ministry of Finance now are trying to extend formal economy because they see the global interest. So this is not only an issue about social security, this is also a tax issue. And this could be probably investigated. This is an example out of so many within the ILO informal economy guide, social protection extension developed by Christina's unit. So I think this kind of example, of course, it cannot be duplicated exactly from one country to another, but it seems that this option, whenever there is no direct transaction between the workers and the employer, manage, it's an opportunity to get formalization of these workers in informal economy.
Okay, thank you very much, Pascal. And I think the issues that were raised by Luca and by others also around the sort of lack of a mechanism in, for unemployment insurance, how that also reverberates in terms of people wanting to take their savings, so-called, out of the system, another link with the labor market. And also the fact that, you know, we've had stagnant wages over a period of time where labor incomes have been quite stagnant. That also has not played very well into the kind of benefits that you have, that you can have within a defined benefit system as well. So those other broader issues around how labor markets are adjusting and evolving will also come in addition to the whole issue around the extensive informality of labor markets. So on that note, I really want to thank everyone. This was a really rich discussion, and I just wish we had had more time, maybe a couple of hours, to really get into some of the issues that were raised. But hopefully this will be one of many discussions, we will have in the KISS Café, I'm sure, more sessions that will be focused on pension reform and pension systems, as there is so much experience in the team on this topic. But before we finish, I really want to give a few minutes to Karuna to give us a quick update on the pension, on the preparatory meetings we had and what's coming up with the pension roundtable. And then Vicky can quickly tell us what's in the pipeline in terms of the KISS Cafe, the future sessions. So over to Karuna, please.
Thank you, Shara. Let me just start my video also so that for all of you, I'm teleworking from home. So hello to all the colleagues. I hope my camera is now working. I wish to first of all start by thanking all the colleagues who have been following up with the nominations for representatives from the various countries, and also for having participated in the preparatory meetings last week for countries within your portfolios. So on the subject of the nominations, let me just give you a short recap of where we stand. We have received various nominations, but we are still missing a number of countries. With respect to the 14 countries that are to participate in the roundtable, so let me just indicate them to you. Argentina, Bulgaria, Canada, Chile, Côte d'Ivoire, France, Indonesia, Japan, Jordan, Mexico, Nigeria, Russian Federation, and Tunisia. We know that Japan will not participate. None of the three constituents will be participating. The group is a closed group. So following also our discussions with the ITUC and the IOE, we cannot even include any other countries even as observers. So I'm sorry, you know, if other countries and constituents want to join even as observers, we are not able to answer that positively at this point in time. So I don't think that they're going to change their mind. We have discussed this with them. So with respect to the nominations, we have already from government seven countries that have nominated government representatives. We have seven employers also who have nominated their representatives. And from workers, we have all but one country which is represented. If we look at the tripartite delegations where we have them complete, we have five countries which are complete. And that's just I'd like to name them. That's Argentina, Canada, Chile, Côte d'Ivoire, and Tunisia. So from the other countries, we have some of the constituents, but not all of them. So we will, we kindly, you know, we'll come back to you to follow up with constituents and where we're still waiting for nominations. So now let me just remind us about the purpose of the roundtable. So basically, the purpose of the roundtable is to provide an opportunity to share global trends and information on pension reforms, to also learn from the experiences of the countries in designing, extending, and reforming their pension systems. So very, very much in line with what we are talking about and our context for today, this KISS Cafe. It's also to one of the objectives is also, of course, to analyze the policy and reform options in light of the ILO's core principles and minimum parameters with the perspectives from both from workers, employers, and governments. And that's why we have asked that the questionnaires be filled by each one of the constituents so that we get this perspective. On the question of questionnaires, we have received to date five questionnaires and two from governments, from the Russian Federation and Côte d'Ivoire, one from the employers from Nigeria, and two from workers, one from Argentina and one from Indonesia. So we will be making all of this information available on a website that we are creating for the participants to the roundtable. We will send you also the link to this. Now, again, this is a website which is private and only for participants to the roundtable, so not to be shared, please, with any other with other groups. In order to support also the preparation for the roundtable, we have contracted Alejandro Bonilla to prepare a one-pager on the giving us a little bit of detail on each of the countries with respect to qualitative information, that is to say, what type of pension system exists in the country, as well as on quantitative information, regarding coverage, legal and effective, and expenditure. We will be asking each one of the specialists to please look at these country notes so that we make sure that they are in line with what you also would like us to see. Now, given the tight schedule that we have, let me take you straight to the agenda. Given the fact that we are now, we have the travel restrictions, the meeting, as you know, will be held virtually. So in order to be able to adjust to our agenda, we needed to extend the meeting over a number of days, given that we have participants from various time zones. So the pensions roundtable will now take place from Monday, 30th of November to Friday, 4th of December. We will not have a meeting on the 3rd of December, that's Thursday. Each day we will have meetings for 2 hours. This is a very, very tight schedule, but it went through a lot of discussions with the IOE and ITUC. We were hoping that at least we could have extended it to 3 hours a day, but there was resistance in that. And so this means that the schedule, the agenda, and the time that is for each of the countries to present their respective positions will be very, very limited. So we will be giving 5 minutes to governments, 3 minutes to each of the constituents to present their views, and there will be a discussion for each country of about 4 minutes. We have to get across 13 countries, and we need to also make sure that the last day of the meeting is totally and entirely taken up by the takeaway messages that each of the groups, the workers, employers, and governments, will bring back to the plenary. So there will be each group will have about 25 minutes to present their position, and then after that there will be a discussion of about 30 minutes, and that's on the Friday. Now, given this tight schedule and knowing all the work that is going into also the constituents preparing the questionnaires, completing the questionnaires, etc., and we felt that it would be very important to also have a little bit more detailed information from the participants. So we have asked participants to prepare a maximum two-page narrative document, which should really summarize the main issues related to the extent to which their country's pension system is achieving the 9 core principles, or not achieving the 9 core principles addressed in the questionnaire. We've prepared a template which provides the issues that we would like them to address, and we will make that available to the participants. These documents will also be made available to all the participants of the roundtable. And basically, when we are hoping that when the participants will do their oral presentations, they will actually refer back to this narrative document and distill their main issues from this. There are two, just for you to know, for when constituents are also asking you, there are two deadlines that we have. One is for the completion of the questionnaire, which we have set the deadline of 1 November. The other is the two-page narrative text, which we would like participants to send back to us on 23 November. Now, to support the constituents, as you all know, last week we had meetings, preparatory meetings, which we held by region, 1.5 hours, where we provided a detailed description also of the core principles. Krum and Maya had provided very good detailed explanations of what each of the principles was referring to and how constituents could address this in the questionnaires that they have before them to complete. So we will be making available the recordings on our webpage, and I will send you also the link to this webpage. So the four recordings from the four regions will be made available this week. Now, where do we stand with this, and what is the support that we need from you? We really need you, as I indicated at the beginning, to also follow up with us on the nominations that we're still missing. I will contact you over the next few days. So I thank you in advance for that. And also, we would request you, number two, to kindly review the one-page country notes for the countries that are in your portfolio. We will be sending this to you in the next few days. And then if you also have the chance to remind the nominated participants that to send their completed questionnaires and the two-page narratives. And if they require any clarifications or any follow-up from our side, please don't hesitate to direct them to us. So with that, I think I'll hand over the floor back to you. And if you have any questions, thank you. Over to you.
Okay, thanks very much, Karuna. We're running a bit out of time. Maybe just to say, because some colleagues were asking if those who are not in one of the countries that is participating, if colleagues could still participate and listen in to the discussion, our GTT colleagues. I think it's important to say that the documents, the questionnaires that have been completed, are not to be shared publicly, so not to go beyond the group that has access to this website, because it's a semi-private website, and Karuna can share the password and username so that you can get access to it and have access to the documents that are there. And I think the GTT colleagues, even if their countries are not included in the roundtable, should be able to participate and listen into the discussion. But again, just bear in mind that this is a semi-closed roundtable. So please, you know, keep the information to yourselves. And we have a little bit of discussion that we still need to have with ITUC and IOE about the status of the synthesis report that Alejandra Bonillo will be preparing, the summary report. There is some sensitivity around this issue, so we need to still discuss with them what this report will contain and what its status is going to be, whether it's going to be public or whether it's going to be limited to those who participated at the roundtable. So there are a few question marks and a bit of sensitivity around these issues that we still need to work our way through. And of course, all of you are very familiar with the really, really great publication on reversing pension privatization that Isabel and colleagues prepared, which has been the reason for some of the controversy, but also it's a valuable publication and has a lot of rich material in it. And I think Stefan put the title in this conversation that we have on the side, so you can have access to that publication. And before just handing very quickly to Vicky to tell us about the themes of the next cafes, I just want to make sure that we can keep the conversation that is going on here on the side with all the different links that have been given in case colleagues have not been able to download it yet. So maybe Vicky, you can tell us if that conversation can be saved. Over to you for a glimpse of what's to come under the KISS cafes. Thank you, Vicky, please.
Yes, hello colleagues. Just to tell you that Luis, Luisa and Quinn have taken notes of this discussion, then we will put everything online on a workspace and we will share the links with you. The same with the chat that we have on the side. Then another thing, this is an informal opportunity to exchange knowledge between us. Then the idea is that you propose the topics and organize the discussions as we did with Guillermo last week. We will support with the logistical issues, no problem. And then any suggestions you have to improve this initiative, please share, and we will try to do it better next time. Then the last thing I wanted to say, well, Céline is not here. Well, Céline, because Céline has already proposed the next topic for discussion, which is going to be in unemployment insurance. Then we will be communicating with you. Céline will organize the agenda with you. That's all for me. Thank you for coming. We were 48 at the point, and this is, I think, it's a successful experience to be the first Kids Cafe. Thank you, and bye.
Okay, thank you very much, Vicky. It's great. We still have 37 participants, even though we're 21
yeah,
minutes
not
beyond
bad,
the
huh?
deadline.
Yeah.
So thanks again from me sitting here in a very lonely ILO building with only Valérie down the corridor and no one else in the building. So stay healthy and look forward to our next Kids Cafe. And thank you so much for all your contributions. It's been really, really great to hear you all speak and keep well and keep safe. And see you next time. Bye-bye. And before I forget, thanks to all the colleagues who made this possible, also on the organizational and logistical side. So thank you, Vicky, and everyone else. Bye-bye.